Hello there, podcast listener. Amber Noel here. It's my turn to be a listener now. I would love to hear your thoughts about the podcast. The Living Church, as you might know, is a nonprofit communications ministry with a heart for Christian unity, especially in the Anglican Communion. And we want to keep our mission sharp in all we do, including the podcast, and have fun, obviously. But would you write to me and let me know how we're doing? What's the podcast doing for you? Is it making a difference in your thinking, your ministry, your prayer life, your daily walk with your golden doodle? Do you have some hot takes on what we could do better? I want to hear it all. I might even read your comments on the next episode. There are so many great podcasts out there. I want to do more of what the Living Church is here to do and less of what it's not. So there are two things you can do to help. First, make sure you're following us from a podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Find us on the page and click follow. The second thing you can do is email me, ambernoel@livingchurch.org. Share with me a thing or two you've gotten from the podcast over the years. And if you want, include something we might do better. Help us stay not just a great podcast, but on mission. Follow us, email me, ambernoel@livingchurch.org. I can't wait to hear from you.
What we write, what we create, is a direct reflection of where we are at socially, politically, spiritually, all those things that we're going through.
I hope that what Steve and I were doing here as brother and sister is showing people how to read this book, because Flannery matters, but only so far as she leads us to Jesus.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. So there's a disgruntled white Southern intellectual named Walter, and he's living on his family's farm. And his family think that he's pretty much good for nothing because of all his fancy learning. And they're pretty much right. To top it all off, Walter believes he is dying from a mysterious, slow-working sickness. Now, does this sound like any Flannery O'Connor story that you've ever read? But wait, there's more. Walter decides to pretend through a pen pal relationship with a social justice activist named Una that he is not white, but black. A relationship forms on this deceit, and a story unfolds. Now, this is actually a Flannery O'Connor story that you've probably never read, and we'll discuss it today on the podcast. Unlike Flannery's other works, a conversion and a baptism come early in this story, and the rest of the book, which was never finished, was intended to ask, what next? So instead of the one fell swoop of the Holy Ghost that we're used to, what does the radical work of grace look like over time? Fragments of the unfinished novel have just been released in a book called Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress, by author and literary scholar Jessica Houghton Wilson, and illustrated by the artist Steve Prince. The story fragments are fascinating, but the gloss that Steve and Jessica provide through essays and commentary and art help us to really unpack what's going on with Flannery. So sorry, mega fan, she was not a saint. And in this broken text, we actually watch Flannery, a sinner like us, come up against her limits as a white Southerner of her time and as a writer. What was she doing in this book? And what maybe was God doing? And what can we learn from her today? We'll discuss Flannery's work. We'll discuss intersections with Malcolm X and James Baldwin, what stories do to harm or heal, and what art and artistic collaborations make possible. Dr. Jessica Houghton Wilson is the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University. She's the author or editor of several books, including Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress, which we're discussing today, Reading for the Love of God, and two award-winning books of literary scholarship, The Scandal of Holiness and Giving the Devil His Due, Demonic Authority in the Fiction of Flannery O'Connor and Fyodor Dostoevsky. Steve A. Prince is a mixed media artist, master printmaker, lecturer, educator, and art evangelist with his MFA in printmaking and sculpture from Michigan State University. He's the director of engagement and distinguished artist in residence at the Muscarelli Museum at William & Mary. He is a native of New Orleans, and he currently resides in Williamsburg, Virginia. Now, pour yourself a big old glass of sweet tea and hold on to your rocking chair. This exploration of Flannery O'Connor probably won't be what you're used to. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, my first question to you is, if someone said to you, who's Flannery O'Connor? What would you say? And how did you first encounter Flannery?
My answer is part of what I recently wrote, was just trying to tell people like how I got introduced to this person. But I remember, you know, when I first read Flannery, I had received the story, Life You Save May Be Your Own. And I was trying to learn to write. And so I thought, this is amazing. I'm going to imitate this story. This is like the secret to happiness, is to be able to write like this. And what I meant by that was to be able to dig into the darkness and to see something else. One of the things that Flannery does is she's often looking at the worst parts of ourselves, but not because she enjoys the grotesque or the darkness or the sin. She usually is just trying to exercise it or expose it. And that's one of the first things that I saw in The Life You Save May Be Your Own. It's like she was able to stare into the darkness and say, that's not all there is. Staring into the darkness shows you there's light, there's hope, there's meaning. And so that was completely a paradigm shift for me as a teenager, being able to see work that way. And that's what I wanted to do. So I was like, who is this guy? He is so good. And, you know, once I discovered it was a woman, then it was just like, wow, I can't believe she did this. And then I wanted to know her whole life story. And then I wanted to read all of her letters. And, you know, so I started studying her without any guidance, without any teachers leading me through her work, just kind of fell in love with the work itself, which I think is a really good way to start a relationship with an author, an artist, is like you are just drawn to them and in love with what they're doing. And they're not just like a scholastic activity for you.
She kind of grabbed you by the gut.
Yeah, she did for me.
Yeah, she does that for a lot of people. And sometimes she rips them out, and that's what happens to the characters. But anyway, we'll get to that, I'm sure. Steve, who is Flannery O'Connor and when did you first meet her?
Honestly, I did not grow up reading Flannery O'Connor, and so I don't have a track history to share. So my introduction to Flannery O'Connor really is through Jessica. And then encountering her, I started going back and trying to read up on it as much as I possibly could to figure out who she was and what she was doing. And the thing that struck me was just how contextual her novels were in terms of the times. I think about, you know, the text, A Good Man Is Hard to Find. I believe that was published in 1955. Mm-hmm. And there is a pretty controversial title that's in that book using the N-word. And it talks about someone traveling down to Atlanta with their child. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help think about Emmett Till traveling from Chicago and heading down to Money, Mississippi. But this child never gets to return. You know, in terms of Emmett Till's true story and not the fictive story. And so I think that that's one of the things that struck me when I started reading the broken text that Jessica shared with me. And so that's what I just started finding all these kind of historical parallels between that which is imagined and that which is real. But also just the fact that that which is imagined comes out of that which is real, that which is around you, that which is stereotypic, that which has been passed on, that which you believe or conceive. And so those are the ways in which I enter in.
It's fascinating that you put it that way, because I think of your illustrations as parallels. I think someone else described them as glosses on the text, and you're setting them. They're not literal depictions of what's happening in the text. You are running another story parallel to the story that's happening within the illustration. So sort of at least two things are happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. But I do want to ask you briefly, there's another parallel that you point out historically between Flannery O'Connor, and this is in the afterword of the book, between Flannery O'Connor and Malcolm X. You said you noticed similarities between their lives. Could you tell our audience a little bit about that discovery? I found it fascinating.
Yeah, again, because I'm a student of history and so much history is in my own personal work. And when I was in college, you know, when we started talking about those things that impacted us, well, Malcolm X impacted me when I was in college. And I just started to just consume every one of his speeches, anything was written about him. Of course, I read his autobiography that was written by Alex Haley. And I was just taking it all in. And, you know, that was a kind of a moment of awakening for me. And also that was like the formulation of me starting to develop what I was going to do with my own artistic voice and so forth. So when I started doing research on her, I was like, wait a minute. So then I started looking it up and I said, wait a minute, they were virtually born in the same month, you know, like within 2 months of each other. And then they died, you know, both before their 40th birthday, but they had very different lives that they led. You know, her life was one of comfort that was, you know, codified or defined by this nation in terms of its constructions. You know, comfort to a certain degree, because still she was a woman within some of these constructions and so forth. She had her own struggles, but it was nothing like that of a Black man who, you know, was born in Lansing, who is arrested and who is in prison, who gets inspired by the Nation of Islam and who turns out to be a preacher. And he goes out in the streets professing, you know, for equal rights, and particularly for Black men and Black women, and then ends up, you know, dead on the floor in Audubon Ballroom in New York, you know, whereas Flannery O'Connor succumbs to a disease that takes her out prematurely, but very, very different narratives, very different stories that are parallel to each other and in almost in opposites, you know. And so those are the things that I started thinking about as I was pondering how was I going to enter into this story, you know, visually. And engage not only what Flannery is saying, but also what Jessica is saying. How do I fit within that, weave myself within that narrative and create a conversation? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I believe that's what Jessica does with the book as well, because she's taking what Flannery originally wrote and she's weaving in this contemporary narrative. So I think we're both doing the exact same thing. We just did it within our own language. She's using words. I'm using pictographs, which in essence are words.
Let's talk about the book a little bit then, so people get an idea of what we're swimming in today. This book is pieces of an unfinished novel, probably maybe going to be titled Why Do the Heathen Rage? How would both of you describe this unfinished novel? It's unique. It's unique to her work in several ways, isn't it?
So with this work in particular, if you look at Flannery, there's kind of this formula that people reduce her work to. It's not true, but you can see how it would happen, where you have an overbearing mother on a farm in the South, and you have this white intellectual Southern student or intellectual. She would have spelled it like intellectual with a K, like, you know, this kind of sense of, you know, pretentious intellectual because he's had some schooling or some education, but it hasn't transformed him. It hasn't made him a better person. But we have these, you know, these two individuals usually, and they really represent Flannery and her mother in a large way. It's very autobiographical when you see Flannery's work. And then there's a comeuppance that happens either to the mother figure or to the intellectual child or to both. And Flannery was always interested in that moment of revelation. She would say that she has to bring her characters down to the point of self-knowledge. And by down, she meant they have to realize the truth is above them and they judge themselves by the truth and not the other way around. And those are the moments she's taking her characters to, is those moments of truth. Well, in this narrative, what's so fascinating about it is that we have other perspectives outside of that duo that have not entered into her conversations before. One of which is a character who's a civil rights activist in New York. And this was based in large part possibly on her friend, Mariette Lee. And she's bringing in this kind of outsider perspective into her Southern segregated world and kind of trying to break her characters out of their blind spots early in the beginning of a narrative.
Yeah.
Which is really important. So instead of moving these characters towards a comeuppance that happens at the end, she's trying to say, what if a character who was racist and blind and not a Christian and didn't see the world that way, what if their world opened up at the start of a story? What would the story of that life be? Mm-hmm. And that's a completely different direction from the majority of her work.
What I think what happens with an artist is that the work evolves with them and evolves with what they are going through. And I think that this text is a direct reflection of her own personal evolution and her own awakening. And you can see that's evident in terms of, like she said, the complexities of these different characters. And I'm really fascinated to see how she was going to make all these characters intersect and and what will be that ending narrative that would be on the other side of it. But I think that mainly it's about that what we write, what we create is a direct reflection of where we are at socially, politically, spiritually, all those things that we're going through. I think about, you know, a Michelangelo who creates on the Sistine Chapel, and there's a belief that he creates an image of himself as this deflated skin that's being held in the hand because he was wondering about his own, you know, mortality. You know, is he truly worthy to enter into heaven, you know, based upon the arc of his life? And these are kind of essential questions that I believe that as an artist, as a creative, that we ask, you know, ourselves, you know, but at the same time, we see just how inherently flawed and how flawed we are and how flawed we are in the eyes of God. And so what do we do with this as we try our best to evolve and to grow and to see, to understand not only ourselves, but the other? That's the narrative that stood out to me about this particular book and context to what she has done before. Yeah. It's about her evolution, ultimately.
It's such a cool image that you bring up with Michelangelo, because you're right. Flannery O'Connor is not giving this complimentary image of herself in this work. Mm-hmm. Right. She ends up in a sense giving like, what is the worst version of me where I am, to see then, can I get into heaven? Like, can I be sanctified out of the worst parts of myself? If I put those on the page, what would that sanctification look like? I think that's just a really good parallel with Michelangelo, because I had never thought of that before. Mm-hmm.
Can you describe this worst part of herself? So the intellectual son is Walter. He's in a country family. We could call them good country people. Mm-hmm. And they are landowners, they're farmers. And then Walter has this interesting idea to write letters to various people. He starts writing to this activist, this Northern activist, and he decides to, for some reason, he finds it interesting or stimulating, or something about it is challenging him in some way, but he decides essentially to put on an epistolary blackface, pretend to be a black man writing to this white activist woman and invite her to come onto the farm. But then, of course, she takes him up on his offer before he can change his mind. And so the novel pieces essentially end with her being on her way to the farm, pulling up in the driveway. What's going to happen next? We don't know. So I'm guessing that, you know, Flannery is Walter. In what sense do you mean that this is the worst of Flannery? I see that like her highlighting the gaps in her own sanctification through encounter with Northerners, through encounter with social activists, through encounters with the social justice movement and desegregation. And you're watching her wrestle with this in the shards and the pieces of this novel. Can you guys speak to that? Because there's so much that's interesting and really beautiful and a little disturbing here as well.
Yeah, I think Steve's illustrations do a really good job of helping to unpack the things that were going on for Flannery, you know, when he's depicting characters. And I'll let him talk about that, because it's when Steve unpacks his art, suddenly I see his art better and I see the story better. And so I'll let him speak to that. But for Walter, when I look at it in terms of Flannery, you have this woman who has assented to a new way of thinking. Cognitively, she believes what the kingdom teaches, that all people are created in the image of God. Cognitively, she says, I'm an integrationist by principle, right? So she has these cognitive assents, but like Walter, she suffers from a pride that has been habitualized to see people as unequal. So she's having to come out of these habits of sin that are systematic in her culture that she's living with literally in her house, her mother. I mean, the figure that you're usually either like your mother or you're refuting and rejecting your mother, but it's a battle still, usually those close relationships for who you're going to be in the world. And so she has these emotional and social changes that she doesn't know how to make and that she's not around. And so she lives in a segregated reality where her mind may want one thing, but her pride and her habits are completely different. And so I think that's what she was trying to do with Walter. He has this assent to recognizing the equality of all people. He has this assent to knowing he can't abrogate the place of God and put himself on that throne. But what does that look like in practice? Does he actually have to like people? Does he actually have to be nice to people? And I think this is what Flannery was going through. She's like, wait, do I need to also like reach out to the people around me and love people who are different than me? I don't know how to do that. She didn't even know where to start with stuff like that. And I think she would hopefully admit that she did wrong in the ways that she went about it. Even here's one example. People always talk about James Baldwin and someone inviting James Baldwin to her home, which by the way, was her mother's home. Flannery, even to go out in public, if she went out to lunch with her mother, she wasn't allowed to talk unless her mother gave her permission to talk, even as a grown woman, because when you're a daughter in a home, you didn't have your own home. It was still Miss Flannery's daughter and she wasn't allowed to speak at lunches. So you have to kind of understand the dynamics of the Southern woman world too, which I think a lot of people miss. So it's not like she could invite somebody to her mother's home. Like that was still a thing that you have to overcome. So she's like, no way could I invite James Baldwin to my mother's home. Like she would never, ever allow that. And I live here. Like I can't do that. But also I think there's some doubling happening because the amazing things about James Baldwin, like being an intellectual in the time period that he's in and being revolutionary, she was also that. So I feel like there's like this other layer of like not seeing yourself. She was seeing him as this intellectual figure. And I think it rivaled her intellectual figurehead. I think there's some rivalry that was happening too, that she wasn't able to see that she kind of portrays in the narrative where Walter and Una are like rivals and he condescends to this rival who's come to other conclusions than him. I think there's some of that going on too, that we can kind of see a good parallel between her and James Baldwin that helps us understand what was going on there too.
And maybe the insecurity of sensing your own limits and coming up against them and feeling intimidated by the person who's on the other side of those limits and already swimming in those waters.
Yeah. I mean, we're psychoanalyzing someone who is dead and can't refute us.
Right.
So that's always dangerous ground. But
sorry,
but I think there are things that we can at least read into her work and kind of try to understand a little bit more and unpack some.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when I think about the different illustrations that I created for it, and in particular, like that first one, I called it Sticks and Stones. And we know that old saying, you know, sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will never hurt us. I just found that phrase problematic because we do know words hurt us. And the sticks and stones do too as well. And so, you know, I started to ponder over those words of him typing and having this fictive conversation with this woman and posing to be something that he is not. And I just thought about the idea of those kinds of constructions and how they get reified over time, how those words ultimately get pushed into the social and the public consciousness and they continue to replicate themselves. And yes, it may appear to be somewhat benign that he's having this conversation with this one woman, but we also must believe in the power of exponential. That which is said to her then gets taken in and said to others. And that story gets, this narrative that's not true gets spread. And we know that those narratives were circulating around to build an institution of slavery, to build, you know, concepts about phrenology, about the size of one's brain, to, you know, all about establishing and keeping power. And if you're thinking about, again, that same time period, you know, in the 50s, and I mentioned one of those things in 1955, that was with Emmett Till. But I'm also thinking about in that same time period, you had the Tuskegee experiments going on and where you had men going to clinics and trying to get medicine for syphilis. And they had a cure for it, but they didn't give that to them. They gave them placebo drugs to those men. You know, and I think about the power of the 1915 movie of Birth of a Nation. And what does that do to the social consciousness? What does that do in terms of reawakening the Ku Klux Klan going across the nation? And again, this construction of Black male bodies within this nation, but also not just nation, but globally. These ideas are being exported. That's part of the narrative that I want to raise in terms of as I was thinking about it artistically. You know, I'll tell you a short story. I was in Brazil in 2006, and I was there on exchange as an exchange artist. I was there for a whole month. And the second stop that I was in a small town and I was working with the museum director and I was doing, you know, teaching art classes and so forth, showcase my artwork. And I was working with the people, having a beautiful time. I'm there for like a week and a half. And at the end of this time, I was sitting down at the table and the woman across from me, who was the director of the museum, she looks at me and she basically says, you know, Steve, I must apologize to you. And I said, apologize to me for what? She said, when you came into my home, I was afraid of you being around my child. And I was like, what? And I said, if I did anything that was harmful or that you think that you felt was off-putting in my interaction with your child, please know that I meant no harm and I'm sorry. And she said, no, you have nothing to apologize for. You did nothing wrong. She said, it's the images of you as a Black man that I have seen in movies and videos. That's what I was afraid of. And I was like, the thing that rocked me to my core is that the woman had the courage to articulate things that I felt before. That's what was so powerful about that moment, is because as a Black man in America or throughout my life, I can go back to moments and say, I felt a certain way. It's like you feel a spirit in the room. Mm-hmm. And you can't just pinpoint and you don't have like direct evidence, but you know that your spirit tells you something is not right and you can feel the energy. She told me what I felt because I felt uncomfortable in a home. I didn't know why I felt uncomfortable. I'm sorry, this is 6,000 miles away from my home that's occurring.
Wow.
And that construction of me has been exported in 2006. And then now I come back to this nation. And I'm living out the repercussions of all these things that this nation was built upon foundationally. And then I encountered the story and she puts this character in blackface and he starts communicating with this woman who is trying to do good and who's trying to do something positive for the community, who denounces her wealth and all these kind of things. And she's trying to make strides of change. And then he plays a game. No, the game has deep repercussions. And so on one level, we can laugh about it, we can snicker about it, but ultimately it is nothing to laugh nor snicker about because these kind of constructions have gotten babies of at the age of 14 shot and killed in our nation.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the seriousness and way in which I was approaching it and looking at this text and exegizing these kind of elements out there to get us to ponder, to think about, to reflect upon. And if we call ourselves Christians and we call ourselves followers of God, wherefore lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness and receive with meekness the engrafted word, which is able to save our souls. Mm-hmm. That's what we should be doing.
Yeah. Hey there, podcast listener. If you've listened to the podcast for a while, you probably know that The Living Church is not just a podcast. Oh no, my friend. TLC is a publishing ministry with a unique magazine, independent church news reporting, a stellar theology blog, resources for parish ministry, many of them free. I could go on. Stop me now. We're rooted in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion, but we have a big heart for the unity of all God's people. You know that I love that you're here, but I don't want you to just stay in the podcast space and miss out on other ways our ministry might serve you. You can go to livingchurch.org and see what all TLC offers. How can we serve you today? One way we might serve you is coming up in September. We're hosting an event with an amazing community of friends at All Souls Episcopal Church in Oklahoma City, a conference called The Human Pilgrimage. What does it mean to be human? How do we live fully as creatures loved, limited, and liberated by God? Join the Living Church September 26th to 28th in Oklahoma City and be refreshed by 3 days of world-class keynotes, friendship, and meditation on who we are as creatures in Christ. Right now, you also get 15% off all tickets with the promo code EARLYBIRD. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more information and to buy your tickets. And I hope to see you there.
I love all of the illustrations, but one of them was the baptism scene because I had seen it in a certain way. And then when Steve brought it to life, like the whole idea of being baptized in the blood was just reawakened in the way that, sorry, I'm like starting to cry on the screen. I was reawakened to what baptism in the blood looks like by the way that he illustrated that moment. It adds so much to that moment in the story. Do you mind, Steve, telling like how you created that scene?
No, I don't mind at all. And I just started, one of the key things I started reflecting on is the way in which water has been utilized in the Bible and is used over and over and over again. And ultimately, it is the blood of Christ that we are baptized in, and that we're reborn in because of our, you know, our belief. And that he is our Lord and Savior. But I also know that those same waters carry the remains of our ancestors when we submerge our bodies in that space. I was a kid who was raised Catholic. I went from Catholic schools from kindergarten through college, from St. Rayfield to Redeemer to Xavier University. I went to the only Black Catholic college in the Western Hemisphere at Xavier University of Louisiana. Awesome. So I'm steeped in all these things, and I was an altar boy. So
all when, you right. talk about
Catholic, when you talk about these Catholic ideals, I know them. I was raised them.
Sweet.
So I know, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. My last confession was 6 months ago. You know, I know it is completely in me. I know the stations of the cross. I carried it. I wanted to I did not want to carry the cross. I wanted to carry the incense. And our priest was to hold this cross out like this as he slowly goes through all these stations. I remember this. You know, so all these things are not only the rituals are very much steeped in me, but again, I'm constantly looking back, you know, as I allude to in my afterword about the Sankofa. It's about the mythical bird coming out of Ghana, Africa, that looks back while moving forward. It is this idea that we must look back soberly together so that we don't continue to repeat these things that are damaging to us, and that we must keep our eyes open to the ways in which these things kind of circulate, as Jessica said earlier, in our blind spots. And how do we bring them into our sight? But not only just bring them into our sight to say that we acknowledge it and we know that there's problematic, that's only one layer of it, acknowledging and knowing. The next one is action. What do we do? Do we denounce all of our riches? Do we do a Christ-like move like that? Because that's what Christ did, you know? And do we pick up our sandals and do we watch each other's feet? If we think about Malcolm X, that's why I evoked him, because when he was asked by the interviewer, he said, what is the price of freedom? And he responded, the price of freedom is death. Will we die for our brother and our sister? Those are questions that I'm asking. And I'm asking myself.
Yeah. And that's where I feel like your work takes Flannery to the next level, because Flannery was good at saying, she said the job of her as a novelist was to show us the devil we are possessed by. That was the step she could take people to. But when it comes to that next step of action, I feel like that's where she just kept struggling. So we see in her work, she's like, I know how to show you the devils that possess you. I know how to say, let's exorcise these devils, but I don't know how to show a character who then walks forward in action what that action would look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I hope that all of you listening would buy this book or consider buying this book. It's a really, really interesting work. I enjoyed reading it so much. And I want to say, because you're using your ears and not your eyes right now, I want to say just a word about Steve's work here. So you start maybe to get some kind of mental image of what we're talking about when we talk about his illustrations. So they're black and white. They are blocky, stark, angular. They're as angular as woodcuts. I mean, are they etchings or woodcuts?
They're in that family, which is called relief. And okay. But they actually are linoleum cuts. I cut with a gnarly, sometimes kind of mark that mimics wood. And it looks just like a woodcut, but actually in linoleum. And the style that I cut them in was purposeful. I wanted them kind of raw and rough-hewn kind of look to them, because I thought that was appropriate for the story and appropriate for the time. It was such a beautiful opportunity that Jessica afforded me. And I'm just so grateful for her, you know, and entering into my life and vice versa in the work that we have started together. I see in the future just more work that we can do together that can continue to create bridges and create spaces for these kinds of conversations. I'm just so grateful to be engaged in this way. And then to think about it, Flannery had a conversation with an artist who was in New York and she's in Atlanta. And now we're in California.
That's right.
And I'm in Atlanta.
And you're in Atlanta. So we got a trifecta, you know, but it's really, it's quite powerful, you know, to think about. Now we have this kind of, we have a cross country conversation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're in this moment for us to be able to have it. So now it really just pushes forward why this medium becomes so important.
Yes.
Because it allows us to just collapse time and space. And draw us closer together, you know, because ultimately, I mean, my work, what I tried to do, and I've been dogged at it, and I've been dogged trying my best to tell the truth of the history, no matter how ugly it is. And so my work, it fits within the structure of where I was from. I was born and raised in New Orleans, and I use this funerary tradition of the dirge and the second line. And a dirge being the mournful tune that's being played for someone laid to rest. And the second line is the celebratory tune that we will play for someone entering into heaven. And I took that same model, that structure, and I inverted it. You know, I did not look at the second line as through the lens of death. I looked at the second line very much like that baptismal scene as a point of renewal.
Mm-hmm.
Or just as we think about, you know, Christ speaking with Nicodemus, in order for man to enter into the kingdom of heaven, he must be reborn.
Yes.
And that's the kind of work I believe that a book like Why Do the Heathen Rage does. It encourages us to be reborn.
Mm-hmm.
It encourages us to die the old and make space for the new.
Yes.
And in order to do that, it's a painful process and it's hurtful. And there will be tears shed. There will be anger spewed. But do we come out on the other side and do we see each other as each other's neighbor? Do we truly see each other as brother and sister? And that's the way I'm trying to look at it. You know, when I do this work with Jessica, I'm looking at her. She's my sister.
Yeah.
Want her to know that I'm her brother.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love hearing you talk. That's exactly right. I mean, I hope that what Steve and I were doing here as brother and sister is showing people how to read this book, mm-hmm. why this book ultimately matters, because on the other side, it Flannery matters, but only so far as she leads us to Jesus.
That's right. Take that, Flannery canonizers. I agree with you. Thank you so much. You know, Flannery just speaks to me in so many ways. And at the same time, I don't like when people idolize her because they really can idolize her. And Steve, you were pointing out she has a real tongue-in-cheek sense of humor that sometimes works. But I wonder if by the point she's writing this, it's starting to get a little old. I mean, you love the racist mom. She's your mother. She won't be transformed unless she's loved. But at the same time, there's a point where that even the sense of humor that we can love so much grows a little thin in the face of the sin becoming more and more clear. And then it's encountering Flannery, realizing sort of the thinness of her own ability to continue relating the way that her family has to Black people, Black neighbors, Black employees, that something's growing thin. She's got to press through this veil, but she dies before she's able to finish this novel. But in terms of transformation, I don't know if either of you are familiar with the work of the theologian Willie Jennings, who writes on the Christian imagination. Yeah, just brilliant, life-changing book. And when he talks about race and fellowship in America, he talks a lot about communion, about joining and the healing of joining. So this starts with not killing each other. It starts with being nice. But I mean, the end is communion. The end is being fully ourselves and being related to one another and owning that relationship. I have a question about Flannery and her. She even says this to friends. She says that she can't get inside Black life. And that's part of her struggle, that it's actually impossible for her, at least. I don't know if she's also meaning that it's impossible for a white writer to get inside Black life, but the two of you are scholars and artists. You have this sense of Christian communion being vital to salvation. I wonder how much you were thinking about O'Connor's claim that this was impossible for her to get inside Black life as you were working. I mean, to Steve, most of the characters in these illustrations in this book are white that you're depicting. And to depict someone in art is a really intimate thing. So are y'all proving O'Connor wrong that we cannot get inside one another? Is there some equivalency here? What do you think?
I definitely think so. There's some equivalency here in that I believe that's a truth. Years ago, I spoke at Dort College in Susan, Iowa, and they had this dinner for me afterwards. And there was a student that asked me this question I never forget. And he basically said to me, he said, "Hey, Steve, my parents, when we were kids, we adopted a Black child into our family. He has a Black brother." And he noted as they were growing up, there were certain struggles that his brother was going through as a Black man that he just could not identify with fully. And he was struggling with it. And he wanted to know. He wanted to understand. He wanted to be closer and so forth. And so he asked me my feelings on that. I told him, I said, you're never going to really know him on that level, on that plane, about what it means to be a Black man in America. But one thing I believe that's universal, and that is love. And I said, that's what's going to stand the test of time. I mean, in any relationship that you have, you're going to make mistakes in that relationship in terms of the interaction. And so much of the mistakes that are made is about you're not truly seeing and understanding your friend or counterpart. Mm. And there's going to be things that's going to be lost in translation. And there's going to be these little mini frustrations that are going to arise. And that's what it means to be human. That is what it means to grow up. That is what it means to coexist with someone. And but at the heart of it, if there's love truly there, then that will fill in the gaps of those spaces of our mistakes, of our blind spots, of our biases, of whatever those things may be. You know, when people say to somebody, well, bless their heart, but knowing that they was like, they were wrong.
We know what that means. Yeah.
You know, that's what it means. Like, you know, no, you're wrong, but I see your heart. Bless uh-huh. your heart. And I encounter that a lot, you know, where I have to say that, oh, bless your heart. I'll throw out one more story that kind of ties in the first part, what you were saying. When I had my first job out of grad school, I was teaching at a high school. And I remember there was an argument that was happening in my class. It was like class towards the end of the class. And it was an argument between this one female student and about three males. So it was like 3-1. And I might as well be part of it too. So it must have been 4-1. But I was sitting on the side as just observing and listening. And she was holding her ground, arguing back with them. And the argument was about women's bodies. The argument that these guys are talking about the way in which women dress, and you can't be wearing this short skirt, or you can't wear this cleavage thing out, blah, blah, and you're going all this whole stuff because just the message that you're sending out into the world, and you're going to get attacked and so forth. And she just simply turned to them. She said, you're always policing my body, but what happens to us policing men in terms of your gaze upon me and upon my body? And that moment, it was something shifted in me where my mom and my dad spoke about my sisters and what they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to comport themselves. And never were they saying to me about how I look at the other. It was heavy on her about what she's supposed to do, how she's supposed to move, how she's supposed to speak, how she's supposed to act. And I say all this story, and my parallel is and I think about that's what Flannery O'Connor is raised in, these mm-hmm. rituals, these rules, these things. And she is questioning all this stuff. Now, did she get all the right answers to her questions? We know she didn't. But nonetheless, she's still questioning. And that is now deposited to us in this moment in time in history that we have to look at it through the lens and the context of our historical happenings. And also by the things that we have learned along the way that we're using to be able to enter in to look at her text and to look at those times, but to look at who we are right now. You know, that's that simultaneity. That's that compressing of time and space. That is our responsibility in terms of looking at what she did and not throwing it all out and not saying, oh, she said this, and oh, she had this belief system. Oh, she used the N-word. Oh, she never really develops the Black characters and they're just really flat. Well, I try to raise a couple of them up inside this text. And so when the father comes in with that plate into the room, and you'll see in the book, you'll notice that it's just not just the chocolate pie that's there.
Yeah, there's some figures on the plate with the chocolate pie.
Yeah, because it's something I've been grappling with for some time now. Is like, what are we actually consuming? And are we paying attention to that which consume and why we consume it? Are we really paying attention to the privileges that we have?
Yeah. Well, I wish, first of all, that our podcast had a visual element so we could do a little PowerPoint of some of these pictures, but y'all just need to get the book. And I also wish we had another hour to talk. I've been talking today with Dr. Jessica Houghton Wilson and artist Steve Prince. Steve, Jessica, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you, Amber. This is so great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. In 2 weeks, I'll be right here with the Reverend Canon Stephanie Spellers, Presiding Bishop Michael Curry's Canon for Evangelism and Reconciliation. We'll talk about what sharing Jesus means to Episcopalians, what gifts the Anglican Communion brings to evangelism and mission, and where we liturgy-loving folks have challenges in that department. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson, and I'm Amber Noel, your host. It's been good to be with you. Peace.